Greetings and welcome to Season 1, Episode 4 of That's What I Think, But I Could Be Wrong. How easily are we manipulated, including breaking down a show on Netflix called The Push? I'm Todd Lorenz. This is my show. You can find it and my music at toddlorenz.com. I think cryptids exist that science should recognize. I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald had a thing to do with the murder of John F. Kennedy. I don't think we know the truth about what happened on 9/11. I think the United States should meddle in foreign affairs as little as possible. And I believe the vast majority of politicians are corrupt. But hey, that's just what I think. And I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe and I say it's strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Hey there! Thanks for listening, thanks for tuning in, thanks for downloading, thanks for any positive ratings, and thank you for support of my show. I truly appreciate it. This week's topic, as I mentioned, is how easily are we manipulated? Turns out it's really not that difficult, depending on the level of manipulation. But before I really dive into that, I need to address something else. How long do you think this podcast should be? I've received some feedback saying that it's too long, that the hour mark is a bit much, and that a half hour might be better. So what do you think? Drop me a line, podcast@toddlorenz.com, or go to the podcast page on my website and leave me a comment there, toddlorenz.com/podcast. And as always, my references are listed on my website, toddlorenz.com. Just go to the That's What I Think But I Could Be Wrong page. So let's get to it. How easily are we manipulated? How easy is it for others to bend us to their will, make us do what they want, with or without our conscious knowledge? Well, let's start here. What's one of the most basic things of self that makes us who we are? How about memory? How about what we remember about ourselves? And how about something that is absolutely vital to our survival? Food. In this case, our memories of food. In an article that appears on Psych Central titled, How Easily Is Your Memory Manipulated? By Dr. John M. Grohol. He says, you may be surprised to learn that it's easier to manipulate your memory than you might have imagined. There is recent research summarizing the findings of false memories, and something found easy to manipulate are feelings about food. Researchers conducted a number of studies to examine the phenomenon. In one, subjects completed a series of questionnaires, including a personality inventory and a food history inventory. A week later, they were brought back into the lab and told their responses had been entered into a computer that generated a profile of their early childhood experiences with food. One of the findings for the experimental group was that either they, quote, got sick after eating a hard-boiled egg, end quote, or, quote, you felt ill after eating a dill pickle, end quote. After learning of this information, the subjects then completed the same food history inventory. Those subjects that were falsely told they had gotten sick after eating a hard-boiled egg or dill pickle demonstrated a significantly less preference for and willingness to eat either food item. It took a minute to consider that. They were told that eating these foods as children had made them ill. It didn't actually happen. It was a lie. But it was a lie that changed their behavior. Those subjects that were falsely told they had gotten sick after eating a hard-boiled egg or dilled pickle demonstrated a significantly less preference for and willingness to eat either food item. The research revealed similar results using asparagus and egg salad sandwiches. The researchers show that positive and negative false memories about a childhood experience can be implanted and that once implanted, they may have very real consequences in changing our behavior and the way we think and feel about the experience. This is why the whole concept of recovering, quote, forgotten, unquote, memories of your childhood is so fraught with danger. Memory is not like a video recorder recording every moment of our lives in accurate detail. It is a murky, complex system that can be manipulated, as this research shows. Consider the potential consequences of this. Think about people who have suddenly come out with childhood memories of being molested, assaulted, or abused, or anything that's potentially traumatic. What if it didn't actually happen? What if these memories were somehow planted, or maybe even guided by a therapist using a questionable technique like memory recovery or regression through hypnosis or hypnotherapy? I'm not saying those things don't work. I am saying there's research out there proving that memories can be manipulated. So it can be done. Who does it? Maybe how did they do it? I found an article titled, 20 Most Common Manipulation Techniques Used by Human Predators. The article begins with, manipulation techniques are common tools psychopaths, sociopaths, narcissists, and other types of predators use to exert control over their victims. Here are 20 of the most common manipulation techniques. It lists the technique and then gives a brief explanation as to context or what it means. I'll only go into it if I think it's necessary, but I'm going to go through or run through all 20. Number 1. Lying. That's kind of self-explanatory. Lying is one of the manipulation techniques psychopaths typically use because they have no qualms about it. Number 2. Not telling the whole story. Number 3. Frequent mood swings. Never knowing what mood your partner is going to be in when you get home, whether they'll be happy or angry, is a very useful tool to the predator. Keeps their victim off balance, makes them more malleable. Number 4. Love bombing and devaluation. Narcissists typically use love bombing as a manipulation tactic. They will go on a charm offensive and get you hooked into thinking this is the best relationship ever. Then they'll drop you like a ton of bricks without explanation. Number 5. Punishment. Can include anything from constant nagging, shouting, the silent treatment, physical violence, and mental abuse. Number 6. Denial. Often the simplest way a predator will manipulate a person is by denying the thing they're accused of ever happening. You hit me. No, I didn't. But I have proof. The mark's right here. No, you don't. Oh, okay. You know, I doubt it's that simple, but it, you know, I didn't do it. Well, all right, I guess not then. Number 7. Spinning the truth. Yeah, people do that all the time, right? Politicians in particular, advertising agencies. Number 8. Minimizing, where a predator will try and play down their actions as not important or damaging and shift the blame onto the victim for overreacting. Number 9. Plays the victim. The manipulator will themselves take on the role of victim in order to gain sympathy and compassion for those around them. We as humans are naturally drawn to helping people when they are suffering. Number 10. Targets the victim. When a manipulator accuses the victim of wrongdoing, they are making the victim defend themselves, whilst the predator is able to mask their own manipulation techniques. Focuses on the victim, not the accuser. Number 11. Positive reinforcement. And I think you see this one frequently with bad relationships. Includes buying expensive presents, praise, money, constantly apologizing for their behavior, excessive charm, and paying lots of attention. Number 12, moves the goalposts. You might think you know where you stand with a person, but if they are constantly moving the goalposts in order to confuse you, it's likely you're dealing with a predator. Number 13, diversion. Diverting the conversation away from the perpetrator's act and moving the conversation onto a different topic. Number 14, sarcasm. Predator will often be sarcastic about their victim. They do this to lower the self-esteem of the victim and to show others how powerful they are. Number 15, guilt tripping. I think we've all been victim of that at some point. Number 16, flattery. Using charm, praise, or flattering the victim is one way of gaining that person's trust. The victim is naturally happy to receive such compliments, but in doing so, lowers their guard. Number 17, playing the innocent card. A true manipulator will feign utmost shock and confusion at being accused of any wrongdoing. Number 18, over-the-top aggression. Manipulators often use rage and aggression to shock their victim into submission. Number 19, isolation. It's easier to keep a person under control if they're isolated from family members and friends who could help them. And finally, number 20, feigns love and empathy. Predators such as psychopaths and sociopaths do not know how to love someone other than themselves. They can't feel empathy, but they can pretend to in order to inveigle others into their lives. Okay, so that's one article with 20 techniques. I found another article that has 7. It shares some in common with the other list, and some are slightly different. It's on psychologium.com, titled How to Manipulate People, Best Techniques. Number 7, the Fear and Relief Technique. In a nutshell, this technique involves playing with the other's emotions, and it is extremely efficient. Whenever you see the one that you're trying to manipulate is about to give up, you help them relieve the stress and let off all the steam. You're trying to give that person sudden mood swings that will leave them completely disarmed. When that happens, the person in question is much more likely to do whatever you need them to. And as evil as that may sound, it truly works. Yeah, sounds like manipulation, doesn't it? Number 2, learn to read people's body language. That seems kind of self-explanatory to me. Learn to figure out what they're thinking, how they're reacting by reading their body language. Their facial expression, their eyes, how they move, their posture. It's not too difficult once you understand. Number 3, you can never go wrong with the guilty approach. Well, kind of touched on that on the other list. Number 4, play the victim card. Touched on that one too. Number 5, use your looks in your best interest. Whether we like it or not, the human nature is quite shallow to a certain extent. We are naturally drawn to charismatic people. If you are a good-looking individual, you can make the best of it and manipulate other people. Life really is easier for beautiful people, but your charisma alone will not get you very far. You actually need to work on it and to learn how to take it to the next level. Number 6, try the bribery technique. Yeah, we've sort of talked about that on the other list. If you reward somebody, emotionally or materially, they will somehow feel compelled to return the favor. Make sure to use that in your best interest when they do. And number 7, prey on their feelings, but make sure to master your own first. The easiest way to manipulate people is to simply make them fall in love with you. When a person switches from being rational to being emotional, that is the right time to strike and make them do whatever you want them to. All you have to do is slowly guide them to feel a certain way about you. However, this technique is usually reserved for the real masters of manipulation, because if you do not master your own emotions first, you may end up being the one that gets manipulated. You need to be able to invite both fear and sympathy without falling into your own trap, and that is certainly the most difficult part. Yeah, great, a how-to list, and here I am giving it some pub. Well, on the plus side, if you were aware of it, it makes you less vulnerable. I'll talk about that at the end of the show. Before I get to something that's potentially really scary, there were 3 other articles I wanted to cover, but in the interest of brevity, I will just go with 1. I'll include links to all 3 in my show notes. There's an article on lifehacker.com called 3 of the Easiest Ways to Manipulate People into Doing What You Want. 2 of them we've already covered, the fear then relief procedure and using guilt as manipulation. They call it making you feel guilty, social exchange. The other one that I don't think we've covered is the foot in the door technique. Says the manipulation technique is evil because it's so tricky, subtle, and simple. With this method, someone asks you to do a very small and easy request and then follows up with the real request. It gives an example of a panhandler who asks you for the time, then asks you to spare a buck. By getting you to say yes to one request, you're more likely to say yes to a second one. Seems to me most of us have been victimized by a technique like this, perhaps most often with sales. You decide to buy something, and then a salesman hits you up for upgrades or add-ons. So the manipulation we've discussed so far is fairly basic, and while it can be used for nefarious purposes, and maybe even for evil, it doesn't necessarily venture into the realm of conspiracy theory or, depending on how you look at it, conspiracy fact. What about brainwashing? Yes, it's possible. Yes, it's real. It has happened, and our government has participated in it. There are many examples, but I'll go with one of the most documented, MK Ultra. And the first page I'm looking at is from history.com. MK Ultra was a top secret CIA project in which the agency conducted hundreds of clandestine experiments, sometimes on unwitting U.S. citizens, to assess the potential use of LSD and other drugs for mind control, information gathering, and psychological torture. Though Project MK Ultra lasted from 1953 until about 1973, details of the illicit program did not become public until 1975, during a congressional investigation into widespread illegal CIA activities within the United States and around the world. Another article I'm using appears on Smithsonian.com, titled What We Know About the CIA's Mid-Century Mind Control Project. It says, it wasn't the first time that the American government, without permission or notice, secretly gathered information on its people, but MKUltra has gone down in history as a significant example of government abuse of human rights, and for good reason. The intent of the project was to study the use of biological and chemical materials in altering human behavior. That's according to the official testimony of CIA Director Stansfield Turner in 1977. That's what he said on public record. What did he hide? What did he not admit? That's kind of what I'd like to know. But the stuff they admitted to is pretty horrible. Here are some examples. In the 1950s and 60s, at the height of the Cold War, our government feared the Soviet, Chinese, and North Korean agents were using mind control to brainwash U.S. prisoners of war. In response, Alan Dulles, director of the CIA, approved Project MKUltra in 1953. The covert operation aimed to develop techniques that could be used against Soviet bloc enemies to control human behavior with drugs and other psychological manipulators. It involved more than 150 human experiments using psychedelic drugs, paralytics, and electric shock therapy. Sometimes test subjects knew they were participating in a study. Other times they had no idea. The CIA experimented with LSD under the direction of agency chemist and poison expert Sidney Gottlieb. He believed they could harness the drug's mind-altering properties for brainwashing or psychological torture. MKUltra also included experiments with ecstasy, mescaline, heroin, barbiturates, methamphetamine, and magic mushrooms. Operation Midnight Climax was an MKUltra project in which government employed prostitutes lured unsuspecting men to CIA safe houses where drug experiments took place. Some notable MKUltra participants include Ken Kesey, who wrote the 1962 novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He volunteered for MKUltra experiments with LSD while he was in college at Stanford. I haven't read the book, but it's a good film. Other notable people who reportedly volunteered for CIA-backed experiments with LSD include Robert Hunter, the Grateful Dead lyricist, Ted Kaczynski, better known as the Unabomber. I think maybe that had some really negative effects on him. And James Joseph Whitey Bulger, the notorious Boston mobster. In 1974, there were also non-consensual drug experiments and illegal spying operations on U.S. citizens. Revelations from documentation on an MKUltra resulted in President Ford's 1976 executive order on intelligence activities, which prohibited, quote, experimentation with drugs on human subjects, except with the informed consent in writing and witnessed by a disinterested party of each human subject. It's also worth saying that MKUltra was not one project. It was 162 different secret projects that were indirectly financed by the CIA, but were contracted out to various universities, research foundations, and similar institutions. In all, at least 80 institutions and 185 researchers participated, but many didn't know they were dealing with the CIA. Many of MKUltra's records were destroyed in a 1973 purge, and many had been destroyed throughout the program as a matter of course, but 8,000 pages of records, mostly financial documents, that were mistakenly not destroyed in 1973 were found in 1977, launching a second round of inquiries. Although the renewed inquiry resulted in public interest in two lawsuits, the 1977 documents still leave an incomplete record of the program, and nobody ever answered for MKUltra. Two lawsuits related to the program reached the Supreme Court in the 1980s, but both protected the government over citizens' rights. And you wonder why I don't trust the government. Come on now. So realistically, we've heard how easy it can be to manipulate people. The government, CIA, performed research for nefarious purposes, to say the least, and supposedly it has stopped. I don't believe that for a second, and I'm sure other countries are doing the same thing. Does that make it right or acceptable? Not to me. But as a citizenry, we get what we allow. So MKUltra has its origins in the 50s, at least that's what we can document. What about now? What's going on today in terms of manipulation? Well, let's explore a British Netflix show called The Push. I'll let the host describe it for you.
Hello, my name is Derren Brown, and I started my TV and stage career in Britain performing a psychological form of magic, which over the last couple of decades has led to a deep curiosity as to what it is to be human. And the show you're about to watch is a genuine experiment into social compliance, involving an unwitting member of the public who has no idea he's taking part in a TV show. And the question we're considering is simple. Can we be manipulated through the familiar forces of social pressure to commit murder? Welcome to The Push.
And that's what this show is, man. I suggest you watch it if you haven't. And if you haven't seen it, you may want to pause this podcast and come back and listen to it after, because I'm going to go over this in a fair amount of detail, and there will certainly be spoilers. So, consider yourself warned. The show opens with an experiment. A guy calls a coffee shop and identifies himself as Detective Inspector Monroe of the Hertfordshire Constabulary. He asks the man who answers, Greg, to identify a woman based on her appearance and how she's dressed. Greg does. The caller says she's a, quote, known child abductor, end quote, and that the baby she's pushing in a stroller is not her baby. He manipulates Greg into distracting the woman and walking out with the stroller, which, as far as he's concerned, has a baby in it. Bear in mind, Greg just kidnapped a kid based on what he was told on the phone. It's not like the caller provided any kind of identification. Wow, right? Derren, again, he's our host, says, Tom, you just persuaded a stranger into stealing a baby. Supposed Inspector Monroe and the woman were both actors. The baby was a lifelike replica. As you heard, the goal of the show, or social experiment, is to see if they can manipulate someone into pushing another human being to their death. They use special effects artists, a stunt coordinator, a troupe of approximately 70 professional actors, an impressive venue, and a credible cover story. The setting is the launch of a youth charity called Push, attended by VIPs, and there are recorded messages from celebrities. There are hidden cameras everywhere, and Derren Brown communicates with the key players from a control room via an earpiece. The whole thing is an elaborate hoax and includes a business partner named Matt of the experiment subject, Chris. The manipulation begins with a simple act. The actor, Tom, handling Chris, convinces him to label some sausage rolls as vegetarian canapés when he knows they're not. This is an example of the foot in the door technique. Chris does a small favor and makes it more likely for him to do another one. They build on this throughout the show, convincing Chris to take part in more serious deceptions. Now, Chris was selected from what he thought was a casting call, but it was in fact a compliance test. Candidates were brought into a room with actors who stood and sat when a bell was rung. No instruction was given other than to fill out a set of forms. The goal was to find people who literally go along with the crowd. It was amusing to watch people be socially compliant based on nothing but observation. Those who weren't compliant were eliminated. Those who were compliant were whittled down from a dozen to four and were told they weren't selected for the show. The attempt to manipulate them into murder through a bogus charitable event begins 2 months later. Now we're back at the event, and Chris, again the subject, is introduced to a VIP named Bernie, and Chris is told Bernie's incredibly generous contribution, 5 million quid, and again the show is British, is vital to the charity. They'll be nowhere without it, so he must be kept happy. One of the subtle manipulations we see is that it's a black tie event, but Chris wasn't told, so he's dressed in business casual wear, which is supposed to make him feel, quote, at a lower status level than everyone else, end quote. Tom offers Bernie a drink. When the offer is accepted, Tom nods to Chris, and he fetches it. Chris watches Bernie eat one of the rolls that is supposed to be vegetarian, but Chris says nothing. He's now complicit in a small deception. Tom tells Chris to grab Bernie's bag. Chris does so without hesitation. It's also pointed out that Tom approached Chris about building an app for the charity. So for Chris, this is an important business opportunity. As the evening progresses, Chris becomes completely subservient, following simple orders and requests without hesitation. Now, Bernie has a heart attack, and Chris is sent to an adjoining room to find some medication in Bernie's jacket pocket. When he returns, Bernie is dead. Of course it's faked, and while Chris is out of the room, an incredibly realistic mannequin replaces the actor playing Bernie. We eventually see how lifelike the replica is, and the lengths to which Oscar-winning special effects artists went to create it. Tom has Chris help him move the body to the same adjoining room. Chris asks about calling an ambulance or someone, but Tom is more concerned about the people waiting for the charity auction to begin. Tom has Chris empty a big wooden crate and convinces Chris that it's in the charity's best interest to put Bernie's body into the crate until the auction is over. Chris helps move the body. It's important to remember that he is at no time physically threatened. He's just coerced through someone's words and the social pressure he feels from both a business opportunity and a charity social event. A few minutes later, the auctioneer shows up and he assumes Chris is Bernie, you know, the dead guy. Neither Tom nor Chris corrects the auctioneer. After he leaves the office, Tom tells Chris that no one knows what Bernie looks like and convinces Chris to go with it. Before the auction, a video is shown with celebrities endorsing the charity, and each one ends their pitch with, quote, push whatever it takes, end quote. All of this and more is designed to keep Chris compliant. The auctioneer starts by introducing Bernie, and Tom encourages Chris to stand up. Chris does. Tom then convinces Chris to read Bernie's speech in front of the auction crowd before the bidding begins. Think about where Chris is right now. He's been in a subservient position all night. He's in the midst of that business opportunity. He's helped hide a dead body. And now he's impersonating the guy who died, all in the name of charity. And it's happened quickly. He sort of reaches a point of no return. Why would he blow the whistle and essentially end a charity he believes will help needy children before it can even get started? Before long, the auctioneer brings out a mystery item. We're led to believe it's the crate where Bernie's body was stored. Tom tells Chris they have to win the item. He goes from £4,000 to £9,000. Once he wins it, The auctioneer encourages the crowd to demand seeing what was purchased and leads a chant of, "Open the box! Open the box!" Tom tells Chris to peek in and say it's iPads. Chris walks up and announces that he's just going to keep the surprise to himself and locks up the box. He does not open it. The host tells us, the TV audience, that Bernie isn't in the box. A different one was brought out. But this marks the first time Chris refused to do as he was told. Darren points out that they now have to let Chris know Bernie isn't in the box he bought. The auctioneer announces they'll have another mystery box later. Tom tells Chris they're leaving, and they go back to the room with Bernie's box. Tom checks the crate, finds the body, and shows Chris where the other box came from. Tom devises a plan to move the body to Bernie's car, where someone will find him later. Chris insists that they be the ones who find him. Tom and Chris load Bernie's body into a wheelchair, and Chris pushes the wheelchair out through the back of the auction room. They can't get the wheelchair out the front revolving door, so they put Bernie's body on a sofa. Tom explains they can't leave him in the wheelchair. Chris doesn't question why not, and Tom goes to get Bernie's car. As a couple of drunks come in, they're amused by what Chris tells them is a drunk, passed-out man. They want selfies. Chris takes the pic with one of their phones, but we're told that he frames Bernie out, so there is no evidence, and they actually show what's supposed to be the picture. Tom comes back, saying he can't find the car. He convinces Chris to help him move the body to the bottom of a stairwell on the same floor. The rationale is that it'll look like Bernie fell down the stairs. Chris puts up just a little resistance, but he goes along. Tom decides that in order to sell the story, the body has to have bruises. After all, he would if he fell down the stairs, right? He tells Chris to kick the body, but Chris refuses, which is the second time he doesn't obey. Not only that, he won't let Tom do it either. Now, earlier in the show, Tom took Chris up to the roof where he met the charity's board members. We also saw Bernie try to sit on a railing on the edge of the building, but one of the board members brings him down. Tom and Chris go to a room where the board members are now, and it's noted that these board members did not see Chris pretending to be Bernie. Now they meet Bernie's wife. She's looking for her husband, but she has to leave. She gives Tom some pills and says they're in case he has an attack that's part of a medical condition. She describes symptoms that are exactly what happened. Bernie would appear dead, right down to a slowed and presumably undetectable pulse, but he would be alive. Man, this poor guy. Once Bernie's wife leaves, Tom takes Chris and the board members, three of them, I believe, and makes Chris tell them what happened. They get to the stairwell, and the body is gone. Bernie screams that he's up on the roof where they all were earlier, and he's pissed about being put in the trunk and the threat of kicking his body. Everything that's happened in this show has led up to the next few moments. They get to the roof. Bernie is pissed off and screaming. He's not giving them a penny. He heard every word of what happened, and he plays a recording of Tom saying, quote, "just kick him in the stomach," end quote, on what looks like a microcassette recorder. He curses Tom and Chris, says the board members are his witnesses, and sits out on the railing to smoke a cigarette, facing away from the people, outwards. This puts him literally on the edge of the building. The three board members pull Tom and Chris aside and say that Bernie is a millionaire and will make sure they go to jail. They talk about the money involved, how the charity is finished, how Bernie will sue them, etc. The female board member points out that Bernie needs to be careful sitting up there, and one of the males has an idea. He points out that Bernie wasn't feeling well. He didn't have his pills. Maybe he'd been drinking too much. They could say he had an attack and then had an accident. Tom and the three board members agree that it has to happen. They put their hands together in a circle, showing unity. One of them asks who's going to do it. Chris asks, "Do what?" They tell Chris it has to be him. It's gotta be him. Chris says, "I don't know what the hell you're even talking about," and is clearly freaked out. One guy says they're talking about Bernie having an accident and tells Chris to, quote, just walk up to him, put your hand on his back, and give one big push, end quote. The others encourage him, and a TV on the roof plays bits from the celebrity's pitch. Whatever it takes is heard over and over. The pressure mounts. Chris says he's not doing it. He's not going to prison. The ringleader says sternly, either you'll do it or you'll leave. Chris leaves. As he gets to the door, Darren Brown, again he put this whole thing together, intercepts Chris and lets him off the hook. Tells him it's a big experiment, shows him the hidden cameras, etc. Now the first time I watched this, I was thrilled Chris didn't take that last step. Yeah, he did all sorts of other things that were legally and morally wrong, but he balked at murder, regardless of how hard he was pushed, no pun intended, and whatever he thought the consequences might be. There's hope for humanity, right? Not so fast. Remember I said they chose four people for this? Turns out they did this same thing to three others, and each one of them pushed Bernie off the building to his death. Two of them were women. Oh, and minor detail, they passed for Bernie by having it be short for Bernadette. The actor who played Bernie was rigged to a safety harness, and there was all kinds of padding on the side of the building, so he was about as safe as one can be in that situation. So 75% of the participants, 3 out of 4, or pressured into murdering someone. What does that say about us? Well, I'll share a few thoughts here in my conclusion shortly. Now, there are ways, of course, to avoid this. You are not doomed to a life of manipulation and shoving innocent people off of buildings while appearing on a television show. I found an article titled 8 Simple Ways to Avoid Being Manipulated. I'll kind of run through it. And of course, all you gotta do is search the web to find similar articles or papers or whatever. First is know your fundamental human rights. The single most important guideline when you're dealing with a psychologically manipulative person is to know your rights and recognize when they're being violated. Those rights are the right to be treated with respect, to express your feelings, opinions, and wants, to set your own priorities, to say no without feeling guilty, to get what you pay for, to have opinions different than others, to take care of and protect yourself from being threatened physically, mentally, or emotionally, to create your own happy and healthy life. Those fundamental human rights represent your boundaries. You can also keep your distance from those who try to manipulate you, avoid personalization and self-blame. Do that by asking if you're being treated with genuine respect. Are the person's expectations and demands reasonable? Is the giving in the relationship primarily one way or two ways? And ultimately, do I feel good about myself in this relationship? Put the focus on them by asking probing questions. Does this seem reasonable to you? Does what you want from me sound fair? Do I have a say in this? And so on. Use time to your advantage. You can exercise leadership over a situation simply by saying, I'll think about it. Know how to say no, diplomatically, but firmly. Set consequences. When a psychological manipulator insists on violating your boundaries and won't take no for an answer, deploy consequence. Maybe involve law enforcement if that's appropriate. A consequence can certainly be as simple as ending a relationship. And then lastly, confront bullies safely. The psychological manipulator also becomes a bully when he or she intimidates or harms another person. The most important thing to keep in mind about bullies is that they pick on those whom they perceive as weaker. So as long as you remain passive and compliant, you make yourself a target. But many bullies are also cowards on the inside. When their targets begin to show backbone and stand up for their rights, the bully will often back down. This is true in schoolyards as well as in domestic and office environments. So there you have it. The question I posed at the start of this show is, how easily are we manipulated? And it turns out, a lot of us are easily manipulated. But it's not necessarily something to feel bad about. People tend to be trusting, particularly with those they know or with whom they have a relationship or with someone who's an authority. And at times, those are the very people who abuse that trust. But knowledge is power. Being aware of it is helpful. And we also covered ways to avoid being manipulated. From a historical perspective, human beings have almost always been manipulated by those who would use us to do nasty, horrible things, usually in the name of profit. War is all about money. False advertising is about making money. Corrupt politicians are about making money, or the use and abuse of power in the pursuit of making money, or in the pursuit of wealth. There's a common theme there, right? Not saying everybody who's wealthy is horrible and evil, but a lot of them are. Of course, the converse to that is those of us who are poor are often considered lazy. Well, some of us are. Some of us just haven't quite found our way in the world. And some of us are perfectly content with the way we are. But you know, that's just what I think. And I could be wrong.
That's what I think, but I could be wrong. That's what I thought when I wrote this song. I say what I believe and I say it strong. That's what I think, but I could be wrong.
Hey, thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Please give me a positive review or a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. That will help me grow the show. Or give me positive feedback through whatever media you choose to listen. If you did not enjoy the show, come back, try another one. Maybe you'll like it more. Now, the song that we're going out with this week is from my 20-08 project, Volume 3. I released it on October the 5th of 2008. I call it a quiet acoustic song about having faith in oneself. And for a long time, it was one of my favorites. And the more I listen to it, the more it becomes a favorite again. Enjoy, and I will talk to you next time.
It feels like a long train to nowhere. Like maybe something out of a dream. I don't think I have much control. Aside from whether or not I stay on, it feels like I can't really see where I'm going, and all I have to go on is my faith. Faith in myself, faith in those I love, faith in what I can do. Faith in what I can do. If life is a ride, then we can't do much except maybe hold on and pray. But me, I'm not much of one for prayer. If there's a God, then he knows where to find me. If he feels like he wants to share a word or two, then I might share some of my faith. Faith in myself, faith in those I love, faith in what I can do. Faith in what I can do. Show me the world and I'll show you pain. It's one of our finest skills. We inflict and endure it for reasons unknown. Somehow I think we should be more. It feels like we may have truly gotten lost, but we can find our way back with faith. Faith in ourselves, faith in those we love,
faith in what we can do. Faith in what we can do.